Hello, everyone, and welcome, or I should probably say welcome back. My name's James Harding. I'm the editor of Tortoise, and I'm embarrassed to admit this, particularly to Tony, Liz, and Louise. I rather miss these regular CBI get-togethers because I don't know about you, but it's felt as though Christmas has been this flurry of data, whether it's been infections or hospitalizations or forecasts on inflation. And I realize that I've become rather reliant on getting a steer from you about what's going on, where it's leading us. So I hope that those joining us join in the same spirit. What we try to do in the next 45 minutes is give ourselves a bit of a sense of what we've learned, what the CBI is picking up, both from you members in terms of business and the real world of business, but also that interaction with government, which in the last couple of years has probably been more important than at any time I can remember. We're joined, of course, by Tony Danker, whom all of you know, the Director General of the CBI. But I'm delighted, too, that we're joined by Louise Hellam, who I hope will help us navigate these big questions on the economy, and Liz Crowhurst, who I hope will help us in some of the weeds on relationship with government, whether it's COVID or supply chains or possibly even Brexit. But as ever, the nature of this conversation is we would love to hear from you. So if you've got thoughts, please do weigh in and I'll pick them up from the chat. Tony, can we start with you? It's very fashionable these days to start 2022 with a litany of gloom. Why don't we do something else? Why don't we start with what you think are the drivers of potentially higher growth in 2022?
The good news is that most of our members, most of British business has come into 2022 with real optimism. And I don't necessarily mean that they're walking around being positive. What I mean is in their plans, in their budgets, is growth and investment. And the real question for the quarter is, will the tailwinds, you know, be outdone by the headwinds? Because you're right, we will come onto the headwinds. We're all living in the middle of, you know, the sort of explosion of Omicron. We're living in a world of rising cost of living and inflation and so on. But in the plans, in the budgets happening right now across British business is investment and growth. And, you know, we've talked a lot, James, about the coiled spring of UK business and UK investment, right? And it's almost 5 years in the making, right? It was the Brexit uncertainty followed by the pandemic. And we started to see last summer, as we came out of sort of lockdowns, a real optimism, which then got a bit of a knockback in September when shortages hit. But I genuinely believe that that spring back is in the plans and it is in the budgets. And we see that from our own surveys. We see that this week from the Deloitte survey. The question of the quarter will be, will that stuff get implemented? Will there be enough supplies, enough labor, enough optimism, fewer restrictions so that we can deliver against what I think is a very growth-oriented UK PLC?
And then give us the flip, give us the headwinds.
Yeah, look, so what I was saying in December, and it was just coming up to Christmas, so you're right, we didn't have a chance to talk about it, was everywhere I went in December, people were saying, look, growth is in my plan. And this is CEO, C-suite executives. Growth is in my plan. But to be honest, I am spending every minute of every day dealing with shortages, particularly labor shortages. Labor shortages now, as we enter January, completely exacerbated by labor shortages plus self-isolation. And so actually what you've got are plans and budgets that are oriented to growth, but management teams still wrestling with the short run. And the short run is labor shortages and now COVID-related self-isolation shortages. Liz will come on to talk about COVID. I actually think the government's following a seriously good path, actually. But that doesn't mean that we don't have, you know, millions of hours of FTE, you know, soaked up in self-isolation. And there are still supply chain shortages. We'll come on to a little bit about why that is. And there's inflation. And of course, inflation, whilst we think in the long run, Louise can talk about this, that will come down. In the short run, it's going to be bigger than we all thought. So that struggle, you know, that struggle between the tailwinds, the intent, the plans, and the ability to execute against them. And I think people are pretty resilient. I mean, great to hear how people on this call, if you're watching this, would love you to sort of submit some thoughts in the chat about whether or not you feel, yeah, listen, I get the headwinds, but I feel I can cope with them. That's what I was hearing a lot of from members. You know, I know how to cope with this. I've been doing this for 18 months. I think I can navigate my way through. But let's not be, you know, overly boosterish about some of these headwinds. They're real.
And Tony, before we get into that, just a bit of a wash up from the end of December, there was definitely a sense for some people and some businesses that it felt like a lockdown by stealth. Although there wasn't a lockdown, there wasn't also furlough payments, there wasn't that kind of support to business. And I wondered whether, you know, when you sort of look at the map of CBI members, there are some that are saying to you, hey, we're in financial services, we're in enterprise software, actually it doesn't make any difference to us. And there are some who are, we're in hospitality, we're in travel, we lost Christmas, and how things look sectorally.
Yeah, look, I think that's real. I mean, you know, we didn't have a CBI at 10 the week of Christmas. I spent the week leading up to Christmas in conversations with the Chancellor. What we were dealing with was, I mean, it was funny, really, because it was the exact opposite of what happened in the summer. So in the summer, the lockdown by stealth was that the government message was the economy's open, but the measures, i.e. the pingdemic, rendered the economy closed. At Christmas, it was completely the opposite. Right. The measures were pretty liberal. Right. The economy was technically open. But the message was Omicron is a huge problem. Everybody should be very worried. And so the messaging was essentially shutting down the economy. And I think the governments were doing it for good reason, which was they're trying to drive up booster adoption. But the net effect was exactly as you described. Empty city centers, empty hospitality venues, the aviation sector because of travel restrictions. So we were back to a very old story. And you are absolutely right to observe that the hospitality sector, the travel sector, the leisure sector, all these sectors that rely on a good Christmas, and Louise can talk more about this stuff, have taken a big cash flow hit as a result. And so whilst I think the government's measures, and they're getting to something, you know, you'll remember in July, August, we published something called Living with the Virus. Well, here it is back in the headlines at last. So I think the government's moving in the right direction. But you're absolutely right. For a lot of businesses, there is a big cash flow consequence from what's happened this Christmas and is still happening, particularly when it comes to absences, by the way.
Let's do COVID to start with, if we can. Louise and Liz, can we sort of divide the economic picture, given what we're seeing in COVID, and then the policy picture? I don't know whether, Louise, you want to go first and say how you see it impacting. What do you think will be the impact in terms of regional differentials, pent-up demand, investment? How you see the last 3 months impacting on the next three?
So I think that we really have seen that pattern of fortunes change in terms of the economic impact with how the virus has kind of waned across the last couple of months. And that, as you say, has had particular impacts on some sectors rather than others. If we look back, like we said, to the autumn, we had a lot of that flagship support systems like COVID, for COVID, like furlough, for example, come to an end. But that actually didn't mean that was an end to support as a whole by any means. There's actually quite a lot still in the system, for example, around the recovery loan scheme and the lower VAT rate for hospitality and leisure as well. But what we're seeing now, as we say, is a bit of a move more to that baseline level of support for those who need it, and then much more targeted at those sectors that are particularly struggling at the moment. So I think that was also one of the large parts of the support package that we saw just before Christmas, again, very much focused on the support and needed around hospitality and leisure, where, as Tony described, you know, we have had this cycle up and down. We were seeing over the autumn firms really wanting to kind of get back to this new level of normal. And Omicron really changed that before Christmas with a rollback on restrictions and that loss of confidence. And that was a particular blow in that really important Christmas season for them. So the team really engaged really strongly with Treasury before Christmas, gathering that important insight from members. And we had that further package of support from the Chancellor on the 21st of December. And I think that will provide firms with breathing space. And there is support out there, like I say, but we understand that, you know, in some specific areas that there will still be pressures available. So definitely encourage firms that if they are in that situation to lean on those packages of support and to think about what professional advice they might need as well. But I think the critical point, as Tony said, is to think about where we've had this pattern of the economy moving with restrictions, that we need to work past that and move to a situation where we're living with the variants and having that clear roadmap out of the current restrictions.
And Louise, are you a buyer of the argument? I see in the chat that Michael Hurst has posted this, that 52% of event businesses in December suffered over 50% revenue decline, but despite further cancellation rates of over 50% in the first quarter, it still looks as though there's quite a lot of resilience due to the diversified ways in which event businesses are operating. Are you a buyer of the argument that actually we're going to see activity shift, that things that were lost in December or around Christmas, we are going to see some kind of, Tony called it kind of a bounce back, a pent-up demand? Do you think that we're likely to see that in the Q1?
So I think there's a couple of factors. I mean, I think that, you know, there's obviously been a lot of restrictions on people for a while now. I think where we have got that confidence, people do want to go out. They want to go out and spend. They want to go out and see their family and friends, to spend hospitality and leisure, etc. So I think if we have got the confidence with the boosters, and we can think, you know, in time as well about the kind of antivirals and things like that, I think that that would mean that demand will continue to be strong. But I think that there is an important point that obviously Christmas is a specific period, and to some extent, some of that activity will have been lost. So it's right that we have seen the further support come from the Chancellor. But as Tony said, I think if we can move to that situation of living with the virus and people have got that confidence, then I think consumers and businesses as well, you know, there is a lot of appetite for investment and spending out there.
Louise, I'm going to come back to you in a minute on cost of living and inflation and things. But Liz, I'd love you to help us through some of the policy issues. And I wonder whether you could start by, if you like, distilling the inbox of the policy team. Right? What are you hearing from businesses? 7 days, 5 days, masks, social distancing, isolation, pinging. I mean, what are people worried about, and what do you think needs to be done?
Yeah, I think in terms of what's topping the inbox, the number one thing remains testing. So kind of two issues there. The first is just general access to testing. So certainly in the run up to Christmas, we were seeing a particular region struggling with accessing lateral flow tests, and that has continued into the new year period. So one of our kind of number one asks to government at the moment is around gripping that testing supply issue. We did see a bit of movement on that last week with the announcement of 100,000 tests for critical workers on top of public sector workers, but it doesn't really touch the sides in terms of the scale of tests required to keep the economy open and keep confidence at that high level. So number one is kind of access to tests. Secondly, this week very much dominated on the testing front around concern around future provision. Obviously, trails in the media over the weekend around free testing ending, and that really caused some concern for particularly members who work on site and in physical settings, and the potential cost implications if free testing is to be removed. So I'd say testing is probably right up there.
Overwhelmingly, businesses would like to see free lateral flow tests continue.
Yeah, I think we see that as kind of a critical part of the toolkit in terms of having mass testing rather than the mass self-isolation that we've seen. So really important that we get a commitment from government on that beyond the short term. The second kind of big bucket, and you mentioned it in your question around 7 days and five, I think businesses are kind of pragmatic that we need to follow the science, but if there is further flexibility, if we can safely get down to that 5 days, I think it would really help with getting people back to work more quickly and exacerbate some of these absences that we're seeing across all sectors pretty much. So I think that's probably the second area. And then the third piece really is just about kind of confusion, I guess, and still lots of queries from members around what actually is the current state of play, particularly in different parts of the UK, given that we have differing approaches across the devolved nation. So still quite a lot of kind of practical questions from members about the complexity of the current environment, and also when can we expect further review of the kind of plan B measures and any potential end of the work from home guidance, because I think that out of all of the measures that are currently in place in England is the one that's most concerning our members.
Is the understanding at the moment, Liz, that plan B comes to an end, at least on paper, on the 26th of January, and that at that point, businesses should begin to prepare for a return to the office, or is it entirely wait and see?
On paper, That is the outcome. So on the 26th, in theory, all of those measures drop away. I think the reason that we're really pushing for this roadmap and clarity on this is that is still pretty uncertain. If case numbers remain where they are, and if they peak towards the end of January, as is being predicted, you know, there is a concern from our members that we see work from home and Plan B extended throughout February. So I think one of the big things that we need from the government right now is clarity around when is the exact review date? Is it a week before the 26th? Is it a few days before? So that firms have that forward guidance to prepare for any return to office, and also for firms involved in administering vaccine passport schemes, you know, how can they prepare for when that will or won't end?
Before we go on to the sort of bigger macro picture, I just wanted to get a sense of, Tony, from you, living with the virus, to your mind, means what in terms of those really practical questions? Do we move to a bigger working from home culture? Should we expect indefinite free lateral flow tests? What kind of policy environment are you expecting the government moves to beyond the end of this month?
Yeah, look, we've been saying for 7 or 8 months at least, living with the virus requires three things. One, vaccines, two, testing, three, now antivirals. You could also add face masks. What is it all about? It's about confidence. It is about the confidence of employees to come to work. It is about the confidence of consumers to go to shops, etc. And that has to be the North Star, right? The political debate will be about freedom. The economic debate was always about keeping the economy moving based on confidence. And so my own take and our take is that for as long as we have a nervous general public about COVID, what we need is confidence boosting measures to remove that nervousness and increase confidence of living with the virus. Not a political thing, right? It's a consumer thing. We want people to live and go about normal economic activity. So anything that inspires confidence is a good economic investment, right? It's why I think free tests is just a false economy, right? You might save a couple of billion quid, but actually testing is what's giving people a ton of confidence around the economy. And so I think my own view is, you know, those three things, right? Vaccines, testing, and antivirals allow us all to live with the virus with confidence, and thus economic activity is booming. And so look, I think that those things remain true, frankly, for as long as the general public has no confidence or has little confidence. Now, I can't tell you when that ends, but I can tell you that that's the whole ball game, right? So, you know, to me, a very expensive test and trace system is less important than quite a cheap free testing system, which is the measure that's giving everybody very high levels of confidence. So at the moment, can I tell you an end date? No. Do I feel politically motivated, as some in Westminster do, to force an end date? No. What we are totally focused on at the CBI is consumer and employee confidence. And for as long as that needs a boost, then those living with the virus measures that inspire confidence, that's the ball game.
Tony, can I just put you there in a point that's made by Philip Webb, which I think is really interesting, because I think part of confidence is having some ability to plan, some understanding of what's driving decision making. And he writes, I'm just going to read it to you. He writes, the difficulty we face is related to the disproportionate impact of policy relating to COVID versus the actual impact of COVID new variants. Policy reacts to this in the same way as it did at the outset of the pandemic, viz. Social measures, etc., even though the virus now behaves very differently in terms of acute impacts on health and healthcare utilization. There is no adjusted process, but there needs to be an adjusted process urgently. Is there, in your conversations with the Chancellor or Treasury or BEIS, a sense that says, look, we need to be able to give people some guidance that says, we look at these particular metrics and we understand that those metrics have moved in the course of the last 2 years. I see Liz nodding. I'm going to come to you in a moment, Liz, but I'm just interested to know what you think, Tony.
Yeah, look, by the way, this is exactly what Philip has said, has been, frankly, our dialogue with government for 18 months, right? I mean, for 18 months, we've been saying forewarning, visibility of decision-making processes and criteria. The government do challenge that. They say, look, when we say, I don't know, in 4 weeks' time, we're going to make a judgment. Therefore, in 3 weeks' time, we're going to look at the data. And if we try and give you more clarity now, then we might give you a less good answer. So we're going to look at it at the three-week point and we're going to announce it. They feel a bit defensive about that. Just to be clear with everybody, right? They feel that actually they are giving us as much of a running commentary as they can give. But I think what there's never really been is, I think, some real clarity about sort of the North Stars of policy or the key metrics of policy. It occurs to me that actually what we've been doing for the last 18 months is the metric we've cared about most is hospitalizations, right? Or serious illness, right? It hasn't been deaths and it hasn't been infection. It's been hospitalizations. Now, if we'd all known that, that would have been very helpful. Yes. And I think the reality of political decision making, not just here, but around the world, has been, I've always said, it's been a triangulation by the prime minister between what the doctors are saying and, you know, what the Tory right wing benches are saying or what we are saying. And it's been a sort of fudge and a sort of constant triangulation of different perspectives. Whereas actually, I think the government's had pretty underlying clarity, which is to protect the NHS being overwhelmed, and that's about hospital beds. But I agree it would be better if that was all clearer. I think, though, they would reject the idea that they're not attuned to that. I think they feel they are being transparent about windows of decision making, at least. But the metrics point, I agree. It's very hard to get your head around what's going to be decided in 3 weeks' time, because we don't have real clarity about what's the metric and what's the target.
Liz, I see you nodding. You may want to add to that. Can I also just ask you just to pick up on a point that David Hall has made in the chat, which is his understanding being that access to free lateral flow tests for business is closed, that it has to be accessed through employees going for lateral flow tests themselves. I also think that's right, but I just want to double check.
Yeah, so just to start with that one, yes, that is correct. So the workplace testing did come to an end. So it's just free community testing now. So it isn't reliant on the employees accessing them. I think we were obviously at points last year pushing for the reintroduction of free workplace testing, but the government was quite resistant to that. And so most of our focus has now been on making sure that at least employees and consumers, as Tony was saying, have the confidence to be able to test and kind of go about their daily lives. Just picking up on Tony's point, completely agree. Transparency around decision making been a kind of consistent theme, particularly in spaces like international travel, where there were points where the data and the countries on the red list had no correlation at all last year. And it was really difficult to understand how that decision making was being driven. We have seen some positive signs from departments in recent months. They've certainly been more open about some of the metrics that they are looking at, and certainly telling us which ones are not driving decision making. So we're getting a bit more of a picture, but agree, looking ahead to the end of the month, really no sense of what the benchmark is to get out of plan B.
Liz, can I come on to a couple of things which are politically extremely sensitive, but I think hitting business in two ways. One is, I just wanted to pick up on a point that Brian Fulton's made, which is, it's great to hear that in England things are moving in the right direction and that the outlook is positive, he writes, but we are still closed in Scotland, nightclubs, with no furlough scheme. Hopefully support will be seen at some point soon. I just wondered whether or not, or just how you're thinking about the four nations of the UK and policy divergence in COVID and responding on behalf of business to government and the governments of the UK.
Yeah, and I think it is certainly something that a lot of our kind of national firms are kind of grappling with, because they've got, in some cases up until a few weeks ago, different isolation periods. We heard from a lot of our HR directors kind of trying to understand what message to communicate to staff in different parts of the country. So there are a lot of practical challenges for firms who have that kind of UK-wide footprint. I think in terms of the way that we've been communicating, obviously, we've been kind of pushing the message, the same messages across the four nations about the living with the variants, the need to roll back restrictions as soon as we feasibly can, the need to focus on kind of COVID secure measures and kind of reducing the level of restriction in order to recognise the kind of lower impact that Omicron is having on the NHS and kind of severity of illness. So we've been trying to, I guess, use a consistent message in the face of inconsistent policy to kind of hammer home that it doesn't matter if you're in Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland or England, actually the same measures should be in place to kind of grapple with Omicron. Clearly, there have been very different approaches and our teams in those areas continue to push hard. I know in Scotland, we are expecting a further review on the 17th after the informal checkpoint yesterday. So we are hopeful that we may see further restrictions removed at that point, as case numbers do seem to be going in the right direction. But yeah, it's a very tricky picture, particularly for those UK-wide firms.
Just one thing to add, which I know from talking to lots of people at senior levels in government. If you're in their shoes, governments all around the world are watching each other to see what's working. That's the truth, right? And everybody is deploying different variations of these strategies. And in fact, within the UK, we've got four nations deploying different variations of the strategies. And just by way of insight, they're all watching each other. And at the moment, I think number 10 believe that they're being pretty world leading in trying to stand firm in a relatively open way in approaching Omicron. And that actually the rest of the world is quite interested in this. And actually Boris has made a big bet in not being fazed by the growth in infections, in standing firm against the data to watch being serious illness. And so what I think is really happening, and I, by the way, the net effect for, was it Brian? Who was it that mentioned in Scotland? But the net effect on members is terrible, right? And I know that our members in Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales are really concerned about, you know, differences of decision-making as well. But if I'm being honest with you, governments around the world are watching each other and looking and learning for what's working. And they are iterating policy based on what another government, you know, we all know we've been looking at Israel because they've been 6 months ahead. So we're watching them to learn about boosters. But I know that number 10 thing, actually, they've taken a really big decision here to go to live with infection spread because it's not driving yet, overly concerning levels of serious illness. We'll see if that changes.
Liz, quick checking on Brexit. It obviously is bobbing around in the pages, Article 16, what does Liz Truss do next? In terms of members, what kind of interaction are you getting? How much concern is there? Is there some practical things that are having an impact now?
I have to be honest and say it's probably not as much concern as we predicted. So particularly kind of hitting that 1st of Jan date and changes at the border, we put out a call via our trade associations and via various other forums to gain insight into, is it exacerbating the COVID and supply chain situation, and the kind of resounding answer so far has been no. So it's one that we're definitely keeping an eye on because we're only 12 days in, and there's still plenty of time for complications to occur. But at the moment, COVID and kind of labour shortages remain the top two issues for the vast majority of members.
Yeah, so I want to say something positive towards government on Brexit and some area of concern. So look, I think the government's been incredibly pragmatic. They've prioritised flow over compliance, you know, probably more than the Europeans did last year. And so they deserve a lot of credit for that. And that's why the inboxes are not going off off the hook. So well done to the government for that. The Article 16 threat, this sword of Damocles, is deeply unhelpful. And so, to repeat something we've said a million times, get round the table and sort this out. Because it's not just about Northern Irish business and Northern Ireland, which I care deeply about, but all our members. This is the whole TCA at stake. And so I think, you know, I sometimes say we back the government's deal more than they do, right? They have to back their own deal. It's not a one-sided thing. This is a two-sided debate. But I would hate for the politics of the moment to grab us again. And we spend the next 3 months with the sword of Damocles of Article 16. We've started to make more progress. We've started to be more pragmatic. So I would say to government, you know, stay on that path. Everybody is desperate for this thing to be resolved and for the TCA to really take hold.
And Tony, just out of interest, is there any reason to think the invitation to Chevening, Liz Truss trying to get people around the table, is a signal that they're actually trying to resolve it? I.e. it is slightly less confrontational than it had been under David Frost, or is that just people reading the tea leaves?
I don't know yet, if I'm honest with you. I don't know yet. I certainly hope so.
Louise, I saw that there was one businessman who's already worrying about the impact of inflation on the cost of his debt. If you, the papers to be believed, Rishi Sunak told the cabinet that the cost of British debt, particularly that quarter of it that's, you know, directly linked to inflation, is going to really get more expensive. How do you frame, or how do you encourage businesses to frame 2022 given inflation, cost of living pressures, energy prices?
I think if we look at what we expect some of the key economic trends over the year to be, if we look at the economy now, we can see that the economic recovery is underway and there is a lot of confidence out there, as we talked about. So we're looking at the numbers, we're expecting GDP growth this year of around 5%, followed by 3% next year. Those are actually, you know, quite good numbers compared to what we might expect normally, although we obviously have to remember that the economy is making up lots of lost ground there. But I think that there are some risks around that, both in the near term and then on the horizon as well. So in the near term, as we talked about, when we speak to businesses up and down the country time and time again, kind of three issues that are coming up around cost of living, including energy prices and inflation, those staff and supply shortages, and COVID as well. So, I mean, we've spoken a lot about COVID, but I think it will continue to dominate those economic fortunes in terms of opening and closing the economy. And that, again, like I say, is where we need to get onto this long-term strategy of living with the virus. Supply shortages will also continue to be a factor this year. And as Liz said, some of those staff shortages have been exacerbated again by the kind of self-isolation absences. And we're continuing to engage with government on solving those. But the really pressing issue, as you said, and the kind of question talked about there, is around cost increases, both for households and for firms as well. So inflation this year, our expectations are that it will rise significantly, peaking at 5% in April. I think there's a risk that it might go a little bit beyond that, and then falling only gradually thereafter. And what we're seeing is that is going to lead to a considerable squeeze in living standards, with real earnings falling over much of this coming year. And we're seeing that the risk of that kind of playing back as well with shortages for some specific areas. It's then fueling large pay demands and again costs onto businesses. But that hit to living standards will be felt particularly by the low income households, who are also facing a cocktail of other pressures as well on their spending capacity. So if again we think about costs that might be coming up in the springtime, we're looking at NICs increases alongside potentially rising interest rates to deal with inflation and higher energy bills as well. And as you said, and talking about there, those higher energy bills are obviously impacting both businesses and consumers as well. So we do really need the government to bring forward urgent solutions to help on that. And I think the thing around it particularly is around smoothing some of those impacts, so protecting consumers from those price rises in April and providing cash flow support for businesses struggling to manage those increasing costs. But that is alongside this long-term reform as well to build resilience against future energy shocks, including greater energy efficiency for homes and businesses as well. And I think, like I say, that investment really needs to feed into that long-term risks on the horizon as well. So growth is underpinned by consumer spending this year, and we do expect business investment to be strong. But from mid next year, that's expected to fall as the Chancellor's super deduction for investment expires. And we see rises in corporation tax as well. So I think both concerns around some of those interest payments, but lots of others, meaning that there's this real concern about costs around for businesses. And while, like I say, if we look at 2022 as a whole, we do expect that growth to come back and productivity recover, it really does settle to those pre-pandemic levels, which actually, if you look at those, they're pretty anemic. And that's why I think it's really important to have that ambition on raising productivity going forward as the only sustainable way to support high wage growth and living standards and help address some of these costs that businesses are facing.
Louis, I just want to pause on this inflation issue in two ways. One is, I don't know exactly who the right person to answer this could be. A policy question could be a political question, Tony, for you. It could be an economic question, which is, and I'll put it not in my words, but Alan Whittle, who's said, working from home naturally leads to a greater employee energy spend. Energy costs are set to remain high in the near to midterm, which will put pressure on inflationary salary increases. Should government be announcing a reduction or removal of VAT on energy, or the rebalancing of green taxes from energy bills to direct taxation? So if I can I just put these, I'm going to start with you, Tony, on the political question, removal or reduction of VAT on energy bills. And then Louise, I'd like to just ask you whether or not you're seeing a pattern of higher cost of living beginning to cement into higher wage increases and an inflationary spiral. So Tony, do you want to do the VAT
point first? Let's be very clear. I do not believe the politicians have yet gripped the significance, broader economic significance, of the energy price rise. And there's a risk that, you know, it's a bit too hard to solve. We'll do the warm heart, that we'll do, you know, warm homes discount. We'll focus on the vulnerable, which is exactly right. It's the first priority in their ability to afford energy. And we miss the fact that, you know, for pretty much masses of the country, they'll have a very, very high rise in prices, which will be, you know, frankly, unsustainable. It will fuel inflation and it will depress demand. And I think, first of all, you know, obviously Kwasi and the relevant ministers are entirely aware of it. They're spending most of their life dealing with it. But I think the government as a whole needs to recognize that April effect. And I think those, whether, and to be honest, what the mechanic is, whether or not it's about VAT or it's about lending and balance sheet support, Louise used the operative word, which is smoothing, right? That cliff, that overnight cliff edge of you know, people on median incomes getting £800 hit to their bills, right? Government needs to, I think, grip that now. And don't get me wrong, I don't think there are any easy answers to 2022 being a year of inflation. And I think you're going to see some oscillation between price rises being accepted or rejected and measures needing to be taken. But I think it's very important that the government grips that this energy issue is a broader economic issue because of what can happen in April as a consequence. So yes, we must focus on the most vulnerable, but you know, there's an awful lot of people going to be spending an awful lot of their discretionary spending overnight on energy.
And Tony, before I come back to Louise on this question about whether or not inflation gets baked in, can I just ask you a reputational issue for employers? There's a strong argument to make that actually in the last couple of years, one of the unexpected consequences of COVID has been quite a good deal of respect for employers, that actually companies have, by and large, really tried to think about the welfare of their employees. Some people on this call may disagree, but I think you'd say overwhelmingly that would be the case. The risk is that in an inflationary period, companies that find themselves balking at the idea of a 5% increase in salaries very quickly get offside with their own employees. And so they're faced with a very difficult set of choices. Either how do you meet cost of living pressures for your employees, or how do you meet, you know, the financial needs of the business? And there is a question which I imagine will come to the CBI on this, which is how do you advise, what do you recommend, what the position is for wage increases in a much higher inflationary environment?
Yeah, I think that's right. But the only thing I would say, James, is that companies are responding. I mean, we are seeing pay settlements that I think most HR directors thought they'd never, you know, they'd never settle for in their careers. So I think companies are responding. And by the way, pay is one part of the proposition right now. And I think companies are responding on pay. But by the way, not because they want to be great corporate citizens, because there's a massive war for talent and they're pretty decent human beings. So I think they are responding on pay. But also work from home, you know, that whole package of support and the relationship between employer and employee. We have talked about this before. It's a major theme of Seize the Moment. That idea that the sort of new social contract of employment is about work as a place for physical, mental, emotional resilience and well-being. And so I think the employee value proposition for most employers is growing apace and getting stronger. And I think they are doing good pay deals. So look, by the way, I thought you were going to go somewhere else, which is, and you saw it from Michael Gove this week on cladding, which is as we get closer to a general election, as the government starts to take a lot of hit for a lot of stuff, are they going to try and do some, you know, anti-business backlash? You know, the energy companies feel it right now, right? Which is they're going to get the blame for the government's price rise mechanism. I'm quite worried about that, by the way. But I think employers are doing right by their employees, and I think that they'll continue to try and do so.
Louise, I'm aware that next week, next Wednesday, we're going to sort of try and wrap our heads around some of these big supply chain issues, labour market shortage issues. So I'm not going to press you on that, but I do just want a final thought for you on the inflation question, whether or not the 2021 version of things, this is transitory, feels like it's shifting and that there is something that's moving in terms of wages and inflation.
So I think the overall picture is that we do expect a lot of these pressures to still be transitory, but that, you know, they potentially still have quite long legs to run. So I think it will still continue to dominate one of the issues this year. I think in terms of whether we might start to see that spiral, I mean, as Tony said, we have seen companies responding, particularly in some of those areas where we have had shortages, and that is particularly over COVID, but actually those are longer running shortages that the UK faced, particularly around, you know, IT and with the move to working from home around digital skills. So we have, when we're talking to companies, definitely seen a large pickup in firms talking about poaching. And I think one of the other interesting things that is coming out as well is around that regional dimension, and where actually working from home has given people more flexibility to think about where they're based and perhaps shifting out of London and what that means for regional pay rates and things as well. So we are definitely having lots of instances of that. But I think that in the longer run, when firms are thinking about their pay, again, I'd come back to that productivity point, and those two things really need to move hand in hand to make sure that that continued pay increases are sustainable. And I think actually what the bigger risk is this year is that for a lot of individuals across the country, we will still see those real wages falling. And so actually the risk is around, will that dent confidence and will that dent consumer spending, which is, you know, the large thing at the moment, which is fueling growth at the moment. And I think that's particularly why, not only for businesses, we need that support to help factor in costs and smooth those costs, but for households as well, to just provide that support to get through some of those cliff edges that are coming in with the, particularly the increase in the energy bills in April.
Louise, thank you. Tony, in the very last minute, I think we may get a chance to talk about this before, because I think it may take a little longer to get there. But Michael Gove's levelling up plan, do you have a sense of when and what?
Well, I think there's no concrete date. I think they want to make sure that the country is not, you know, constantly really focused on one issue, i.e. COVID. So I think the white paper is incredibly important to them. I think the reason they didn't publish it before Christmas, even though it was ready, was because it just felt the wrong thing to do in the middle of a sort of national COVID crisis. So I think, you know, when it looks like COVID is not crowding out discussion of all else, they really wanted to get a hearing. Ooh, we'll see it. There's been a lot, we expect there to be a lot about devolution and public services and role of government and levelling up. What I'm hoping for, and I spoke to Michael before Christmas about our perspective on this, is a lot more on economic growth, is a lot more on what we've been talking about, competitiveness, clusters, genuine economic activity that creates more jobs, and to Louise's point, more productivity and wages. So I'm still waiting to hear what will be in it. We've made a very strong case for it to have more economics and more business. Let's wait and see.
All right, well, listen, just to say, Liz Crowhurst, Louise Helen, Tony Danker, thank you very much. A really information-packed 45 minutes. I really appreciate it. Thank you for making the time. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for the first CBI at 10 of the year. Look forward to seeing you next Wednesday. As we say, we're going to be talking about labour shortages, supply chains, and the picture on the economy more broadly. Between now and then, have a very good week.